Good afternoon. Y'all got to enjoy some birthday cake. That was yesterday for me, but I believe in celebrating all week long, so I'm glad that y'all got to partake of that chocolate cake. If you're in the back rooms and want to come out, feel free to do that at any time. You're not going to bother me at all. Today we're going to be talking about difference making, and we've been talking in different things. And I have to confess, when I read this passage initially, my first thought was service, making a difference through service, because it's, you know, if they want you to walk a mile, walk 2 miles. But the more I got into it about smite your cheek, turn the other cheek, and, you know, don't demand repayment of a loan, I realized that it's all about the generosity of attitude. Generosity of attitude. Now, I'm going to talk about generosity of finances later on in another session, but generosity of attitude, it's not thinking how I can, my dad said, some people's philosophy is get all you can all you get, and sit on a can. You know, it's the opposite of that kind of philosophy. After September 11th, 2001, David Letterman actually canceled his show for a week. He just took a kind of a respite from the show, and just in honor of what was going on in New York City. And when he came back on the first show, he spotlighted a small agricultural town in Montana. He said the 1,600 people of Shoto had suffered through 3 years of drought and economic hardship. Yet on the Sunday following the 9/11 bombings, they held a rally in the high school auditorium to raise money for the people of New York City. You think about the people of New York City being rich and well-to-do, and these poor little farmers in their drought. Letterman told his office, quote, "If that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about the spirit of the United States," and then his voice trailed off and his voice broke. Living in New York City, he realized the sacrifice people were making elsewhere. And that's really the spirit that is involved in the passage that we're talking about. A spirit that doesn't regard yourself first, but regards others first. It's that spirit of love. So I've got a little animated video I want you to see entitled Reimagining Generosity. That generosity is not just about dollars and cents. Generosity is about the attitude of your life. So let's take a look at that.
We all know what generosity is. Generosity is when the haves give to the have-nots. It's the billionaire pledge, the big gift, the big check. It's stewarding your time, talent, and treasure wisely, to share the excess with others. But if we have the right map, why can't we find our way? Christians tithe a far smaller share of their income today than they did during the Great Depression. For all the calls to stewardship and radical giving in recent decades, our wealth has skyrocketed, debt has expanded, and giving has plummeted. The Bible presents a much grander, richer vision of generosity. Generosity is central to the heart of God. It's not about money, and it's not about me. We're created in the image of the greatest giver in the universe. Everything we have is a gift. God made us by and for generosity. J.I. Packer calls generosity the focal point of God's moral perfection. God gave us life so that we could give life to one another. God gave us Christ so we could give Christ in us to others. This means generosity is not merely a luxury of the rich. It stands at the heart of our creation, our salvation, our purpose. That's why generosity is about so much more than money. Financial stewardship is not the capstone, but merely the groundwork of a generous life. If stewardship is like the law, generosity is like grace, surprising, extravagant, and always overflowing our petty calculations of what's possible, prudent, and deserved. The generous giver does not build himself up. He lays himself down to lift up another. Jesus did not just give us things. He gave himself to us and reconciled with us. Christ-like generosity is never merely transactional. It's relational. It's not just sending food to the tables of the poor. It's inviting the poor to our tables. And when we've learned to love deeply, relational generosity becomes sacrificial generosity. Like Christ, we make ourselves poor to make others rich. So what if we truly began to give our first and finest, not the least and leftover? What if we took righteous risks for a kingdom harvest? What if we tore down the walls and gave ourselves one to another? What if we were less intent on building a legend of greatness than forming a legacy by making others great? What if we gave not only our excess, but our essence, helping men and women become who God made them to be? See, generosity is not an obligation, but an invitation. An invitation to participate in God's redemption of all things and to know the great joy of the great giver as we live the life that's truly life.
Reimagining generosity. Let's take a look at that in light of our scripture. Jesus came into a culture, a Jewish culture, that was rules and boundaries. Rules and boundaries. There were dozens of laws that had to do with the observance of the Sabbath. Couldn't pluck a gray hair on the Sabbath. Couldn't look in a mirror because you might pluck a gray hair, and that's work. Couldn't draw a chair across your yard because that would be interpreted as plowing. On and on and on it goes. All the rules, all the boundaries. You could do this, but you couldn't do that. So in that culture, Jesus spoke these words in Matthew 5, 38 to 42. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, don't resist an evildoer. On the contrary, if anyone slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. And as for the one who wants to sue you and take away your shirt, let him have your coat as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to the one who asks, and don't turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Well, on the surface of it, that just strikes us as wrong. All wrong. Back way before Bill Cosby got into legal problems, he was famous for his interaction with children, especially interviewing children. And one day he asked Peter on live TV, do you try to do the things Jesus told you to do? The little boy Peter, knowing he had never met Jesus, never heard Jesus, he bluntly said, Jesus didn't tell me to do nothing. Well, Cosby tried to evoke the boy's memory by saying, I mean, like turning the other cheek. And Peter said, what's that mean? And Cosby said, well, if someone hits you, you don't hit him back. And the little boy said, Jesus wants me to be a wimp? He goes, no, not a wimp. He wants you to be a lover of peace. And Peter said, well, that doesn't sound smart. Why didn't the guy who hit me become a lover of peace first? Cosby said, well, that's the whole point of Jesus' message. You have to be bigger than the other person. To which Peter seriously considered and said, if I'm bigger than the other person, then I'm definitely going to hit him back. Well, we want to make this about a fist fight. And that's really not what Jesus was speaking into. Let me give you some principles of this passage that would apply to us today, maybe even today at work. Number one, a believer doesn't take offense. A believer doesn't take offense. As I said in your note, this smiting on one cheek, turn the other cheek, cheek slapping was far more used to insult than to injure. It was like, in Edwardian times, they took their glove off and hit you with their glove. It wasn't meant to hurt you. It was meant to insult you. So if you got slapped and then the person came around with a backhand slap, that's a double insult. So a follower of Jesus, he's saying, it's not to be a wimp. It's not to let somebody beat you to death. It's simply not to be quick to take an insult, not to be quick to take offense. We could put it like this. I've talked about justice, mercy, and grace, but let me flip it a little bit and say justice is not getting what is deserved. Okay? Someone slaps me on one cheek, I slap him back. That's the eye for an eye, the tooth for the tooth. That's the old law of retaliation. So justice is getting what is deserved. He hits me, I hit him back. Mercy is not getting what is deserved. He hits me, I don't hit him back. But grace, and this is the wonderful theology of God's abundant and lavish love, grace is giving what is undeserved. In other words, a person hits me, I don't just not hit him back, but I actually exude love towards that person. I try to reconcile. Now, that probably doesn't relate real well at work. You don't have a lot of people slapping you at work. But let's just think about verbal slaps. Let's think about insults. Andy Stanley, in his book Enemies of the Heart, our entire staff is going through this and we're studying this. And he talks about most of the enemies of the heart, that guilt, that anger, those sorts of things are all about transactional things. Anger, he says, is you owe me. Somebody cuts you off in traffic and you immediately think, where did you get your driver's license? At a bubblegum machine? In other words, you owe me the respect of observing the law. You take it to a family situation. Someone, your reality, their reality falls short of your expectation. They were supposed to do this, but they didn't do it. Why do I have to keep telling you over and over to do this? You didn't do it. It gets us angry because you owe me. And so justice is getting the repayment of that debt. They owe me, I'm going to collect. Now, I may collect through the silent treatment. I may collect through a verbal barrage. I may collect by trying to get back at them. Mercy is just kind of letting it pass. But grace is this attitude of generosity. They owe me, but I'm not only going to forgive it, I'm going to serve them back. I'm going to repay evil with good. Now, that runs counter to our natures. But it shouldn't run counter to the nature that we receive by Christ, the grace-filled nature of the Christian. We ought to be, again, salt, light. We ought to stand out in a really dark climate. Remember the parable of the debtor, Matthew 18? Guy goes to the king. He owes the king like literally a king's ransom, like an amount of money that could never be repaid in 10 lifetimes. And the king forgives him. The king says, you no longer owe me that debt. Then this steward, the one that evidently had embezzled a lot of money from the king, goes out to one of his servants who owed him maybe like a day's wage, just a paltry amount. And he began to verbally abuse him and threaten to send him to prison if he didn't pay back every cent that he was owed. When the king's servants saw what was going on, they told the king. The king brought the original guy back in, and he said, you have really, really messed up. I exhibited mercy towards you, which you've not exhibited toward your fellow person. Because of that, I'm going to collect my debt. You're going to go to debtor's prison until every last cent is paid. A harsh example, but it gives the basis of which we can return good for evil. You see, Jesus Christ, with his death on the cross, forgave every wrong we've ever done. Things that we couldn't repay in 10 lifetimes, Jesus Christ not only solved the problem of justice, the wages of sin is death, well, he died on the cross. He exhibited mercy, and while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. But not only that, it's not just escaping hell, it is gaining heaven. That's grace. And so he said, in light of that, that I have overlooked your offense, how can you not overlook other people's offense? Billy Graham, lots been written about Billy Graham lately, going on to heaven. His first great crusade was in Los Angeles. A lot of stories came out of that. But little known, some of the local preachers didn't like it. They took offense at it. This idea of going in a big circus tent and having thousands of people come at night. I mean, it really caused them to reexamine what they were doing. And so their reaction was negative. Their reaction was to slap him on the one cheek, if you will. And a newspaper reporter came to him one night and said, we've interviewed several local pastors who feel like you've set the church back 100 years. And Billy said, well, for that, I probably need forgiveness. He said, my intent in doing this was to set the church back 2,000 years. Don't take offense. Give grace for injury. So a believer slapped on one cheek, they're willing to turn the other cheek. And often that's verbal. Often that is in doing things. It's not keeping an account of wrongs. When we studied love the other day, it said love does not even notice when others do it wrong. That's the issue that we have here. The second thing I would say is a believer doesn't stand on rights. Most of the marital and family problems that I deal with have to do with this whole thing of rights versus responsibilities. That as a wife, I have the right for a husband to come home on time. As a husband, I have the right to a home-cooked meal every once in a while. And on it goes. I was talking to one of our staff yesterday who said, I just get so angry at my children. And he said, it just kind of blows up all at once, and then it kind of goes away. But he said, I feel so bad. And I said, does it come down to the fact that you feel like you have the right to a child who minds? You have the right to a child who does what you say that you want them to do? And he said, you know, it really does. My expectation is when I tell them to go to bed, they'll stay in bed. And when they get up and keep checking and keep bugging me, I get mad because I feel like I have the right for them to do what I ask them to do. Most things, most problems in marriage, most problems in child rearing come back to that rights versus responsibilities. Billy Graham and Ruth Graham were really different in a lot of ways. And one day they said to Billy, Dr. Graham, how do you reconcile your differences? And he said, we don't. We've agreed that we are happily incompatible. Think about that. We're happily incompatible. So many divorces are based on irreconcilable differences. And as Christians, we have to realize we don't have to change the other person. That's God's business, changing people. Our business is to live as much as possible with ourselves, be at peace with all people. And it's all a matter of perspective. Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, author James Agee, recalls a personal experience from the Great Depression. Now, my dad grew up in the Great Depression. He tells me about living in cardboard shacks and begging food on the street. I mean, it was a really, really hard time that most of us can't imagine. Deep in Appalachia, the writer struck up a conversation with an impoverished elderly woman. She lived in a tiny shack with dirt floors, no heating, and no indoor plumbing. During the course of their visit, A.G. asked, quote, what would you do if someone came along and gave you some money to help you out? The old woman thought for a moment and then replied, I guess I'd give it to the poor. See, that's the attitude of generosity. It's not focusing on what I need, not focusing on what I don't have. It's focusing on how God can use me to be a grace gift to other people. I remember talking to a man. I thought he was old at the time. He's probably younger than I am now. But he was talking about his 87-year-old mother, and she's in a retirement home. And I said, Ken, what does she do with her time? And he says, every Tuesday and every Thursday, she goes to another facility to help out those old people. It's all perspective. It's not what am I owed, it's what can I give. That's truly a life of generosity. And it doesn't matter how much money you make. It doesn't matter how talented you are. It all has to do with attitude. So a believer doesn't stand on rights. Thirdly, a believer doesn't get by with the minimum. This go the second mile has really become a metaphor in our language for lavish attention. And I think it was probably related to the old Roman law that they could require a native of the country that they were occupying to carry their packs a mile. And so you can imagine the Roman occupation was wildly unpopular in Palestine. One time Jesus was asked, what about those Galileans that the governor mixed their blood with their sacrifices? It had to do with a riot that had happened in Jerusalem. And the Romans were just ruthless about those things. They would just cut people down. One writer talked about a road lined with hundreds of crucifixes where there were Galilean men, Jewish men, crucified for crimes against the Romans. And so the Roman occupation was not looked upon with favor. It was wildly unpopular. And you can imagine a guy that had been working in the fields all day long, and a Roman soldier came along and said, take my 80-pound pack and carry it the next mile. Well, if I were a young Jewish man or an old Jewish man and I was required to do that, I would know exactly how many steps were in a mile. I know exactly how many steps. And when I got to that last step, that pack was going to come off because he could only require me to go a mile. But Jesus said, don't have that kind of attitude. Don't do just what's required. Don't just get by on the minimum. He said, carry it 2 miles. Be a person of generosity. When the plate was passed in church one day, the child noticed their dad put the dollar in the plate. And the mother said, your father gives till it hurts, but unfortunately he has a low threshold for pain. That's often the way it is with us. We feel like we're doing great, but then we have the wrong standard. I did a study for y'all back in October following Hurricane Harvey, and I showed pictures of all of our household goods out on the curb for the dump truck to come by and pick up for the garbage. And the title of that, When Your Treasure Becomes Trash. And threw away stuff. My wife is still throwing away stuff. And she said, you know, it just doesn't matter anymore. It's the stuff I took so much time picking out this collectible for our house and this piece of furniture. It just doesn't matter. And I've often struggled with the idea, what if someone came in the week before Harvey visiting my home? Now, this is not this far off. When I was over in Korea, the missionary warned us. They said, don't point out something in the home that you like because they'll give it to you. That's just the Korean mindset. They'll take it off the wall. They'll take it, you know, a vase off the cat. They'll give it to you if you say you like it. So what would have happened if someone the week before Harvey had come into my house, looked at my favorite leather recliner where I've watched hundreds of football games, this was my happy place in my home, and said, I really like that recliner. Can I have it? Can I have it? Probably would have said no. And yet 8 days later, I was throwing it away and they were carrying it off to the dump. It's a matter of having an attitude of generosity that surprises people, that is unexpected, that's not content with the minimum, that wants to do more. The last thing I would say is a believer doesn't hoard resources. And like I said, I'll be talking more about this in a later study on finances. But he said, and I struggle with this, give to the one who asks you. Don't turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Well, Proverbs has a lot about borrowing. Proverbs has a lot about not co-signing a note, that, you know, the servant, the borrower is servant to the lender, you know. And so one time I asked my dad about that. And he said, David, I've had a lot of people in my life. And my dad was a successful businessman before he became a pastor. And he said, I've had a lot of people in my life ask me for a loan. And he said, I've gotten all kinds of stories. They're going to pay me back on payday next Monday. They're going to sell something and pay me back. They've got it all. I've heard every story under the gun. But he said, I've never had one person ever pay me back. And he said, so I had to come to the decision that this was God's money. And if someone came to me in need, I had to be a good steward of that money. And if God had laid it on my heart that they needed the money more than I did, I wasn't going to loan it to them. I was going to give it to them. And that's really the heart of this thing. I remember our college minister, Mike Thompson, he didn't have any money to speak of. And we had this rule, this strict rule, you don't ever just give out cash. Because people will go use it to buy drugs and alcohol and all that sort of thing, you know. You just don't ever give. We had a process. They had to fill out a form. They had to be interviewed. We pay their light bill or whatever. This is back in Oklahoma. But he was like leaving the church after a college activity. It was Saturday evening, and a guy comes walking across the parking lot to him, and he says, man, I just need $20 to buy gas to get to Lindsay so I can get home. I'm stranded. Can you help me out? And Mike took $20 out of his wallet. He held it out. The guy grabbed it. Mike held on to his end and said, dear Jesus, if he uses this to buy liquor, let it rot his liver and then let it go. So there's this, you know, problem of just giving away money that's, I, you know, my wife, when she sees a guy with a cardboard sign on the corner, she wants to always roll down the window and give a dollar. And I said, you know, I don't want to support a habit. I want to get them into a, I try to give them something that'll get them into a job training program. Star of Hope has a wonderful ministry of retraining people. I try to take the long look at it. But he said, don't do it because you're tight. Don't do it because you're selfish. Do it in the best interest of the other person. A believer doesn't hoard resources. Earlier this month, famous Englishman Sir Roger Bannister passed away. Anybody know what Roger Bannister is famous for? Yeah, he broke the 4-minute mile. It's interesting, before that happened, a lot of physicians thought it was a physical impossibility because the record for the mile really hadn't been lowered much in the last 9 years. Well, there was World War II that happened that kind of interrupted track and field exercises. But there were all these wild theories that if someone ran under 4 minutes, their heart would explode, their hair would catch on fire. I mean, there was all kinds of weird things out there because it had never been done. And Roger Bannister was really, by our standards today, a part-time runner. He was a student at Oxford. He was getting medical training. The day that he broke the 4-minute mile, he literally had gone through a shift at the hospital, 8 hours, got on a train. It was a windy, rainy day where they were running this. And when he did it, became the first person in history to run 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds. It's reported that a student ran into a class at Oxford and said, "Bannister did it! He shaved 0.6 seconds off the mile." And the Don, who didn't like the idea that his class was interrupted, said, "And what does the good Englishman propose to do with that half second?" Well, that it was met with worldwide acclaim. Interestingly enough, 2 years earlier at the Helsinki Olympics in 1952, Bannister was favored to win the 1,500 meters, but he finished fourth. He didn't medal at the Olympics. He said, "Had I medaled, I probably would have given up running, and I would have devoted myself to medicine." He kept on training for 2 years, and on this unlikely day, May 6, 1954, he became the first man in history to make the 4-minute mile. Interestingly enough, his official title is Sir Roger Bannister, and he wasn't given his knighthood because he ran a sub-4-minute mile. He, and I'll just quote from his biography here. He said he quit running after breaking the mile because he wouldn't have time to train properly. Quote, "There would be little satisfaction for me in giving a second-rate performance, and it would be wrong to give one when representing my country. History will remember him as a runner, but he had no doubt that his greatest satisfaction came from his long career as a neurologist. His benefit, his contributions to medicine." He wisely put sports in the proper perspective by stating, quote, "I think sports is a thing of growing up and becoming a student. Success doesn't require ideal settings. It often occurs after failure. It requires effort that rises above mediocrity and seems impossible." He could have gotten by on his record as the first person to run a sub-4-minute mile, but he devoted himself to medicine, developed a life of generosity, of giving back. He said, "Don't know me as a runner. Know me as one who gave back to humanity." Let us all be known that way. Not for our skill at work, but for our humanity at work. Not for the amount of money we make, but our generosity of feelings. Not as one who goes a mile and drops the pack, but is willing to give lavishly of generosity and live a life of service like Roger Bannister. Let's pray. Father, I thank you so much for just so many examples of history. Mother Teresa, Billy Graham, on and on and on the list goes of people who thought other people's needs were more important than their wants. Help us to live that kind of life of generosity. Help us, Father, not to take offense. Help us to do more than the minimum. Help us, Father, to be known as salt and light wherever we are. I pray that now in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless y'all. See you next week.